Welcome back to the program. 25 years ago, Gordon Gekko told us that greed was good, that it was the essence not just of capitalism, but of every aspect of our society. When we look back at that movie moment, we see that it came almost halfway between the beginning of what our guest Jeff Madrick calls the age of greed and the crash and recession of 2008-2009. How did we get here? What are the common threads and personalities that forever changed our financial landscape over the past 40 years? This is our focus this morning. It is my pleasure to be joined by Jeff Madrick. He's a contributor to the New York Review of Books, a former economics columnist for the New York Times. His previous books include The End of Affluence and Taking America. He's written for the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the American Prospect. It is my pleasure to welcome Jeff Madrick to this program to talk about his latest work, Age of Greed: The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. Jeff Madrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Jeff.
Great to have you here. One of the things you argue is that all of the things that we've certainly been dealing with lately didn't just come out of the blue, that there's a pretty clear thread that runs from the early 1970s right on through the financial crises we've been facing today.
Yeah, I think you've caught the essence of the book. Obviously, there are a lot of books, some of them very good, about what happened in the 2000s. I don't think we can understand what happened in the 2000s unless we go back to the 1970s, and to some degree even in the 1960s, and begin to get a feel for what became, in my view, an assault on government authority and oversight. But we had, as a consequence of that, as a consequence of deregulation, and not merely the ending of regulations, but simply the lack of enforcement of regulations, ongoing financial crises and what economists would call misallocation of capital. In other words, not putting our precious savings where it could be most productive. That's been going on since the early 1970s. In every decade, we've, to put it simply, wasted significant amounts of money, and it culminated in the catastrophe we've just been going through.
And part of what you argue is that it was economic circumstances, economic situations, that created the backlash to government, which created less and less regulation, or deregulation, I should say, which led to more and more financial problems.
I think the economic circumstances in the 1970s exactly created so much confusion, so much anger, and even panic on the part of the American people that they were looking to blame something. Now, government had been, I don't want to, this is not a simple history, a monocausal, you know, one thesis explains everything, because government and Washington had been losing credibility since the Vietnam War, since Watergate. I think there was some anger in the nation over the Great Society in some sense that it favored minorities, so there may have been some ethnic, racial issues involved. But essentially, in the 1970s, inflation soared and unemployment soared simultaneously. And it looked like government did not know how to handle that. Moreover, many people, including the famous economist Milton Friedman, were saying it was government's fault that all this was happening. The government was too big, the deficits were too high. All of that was a vast and rather tragic oversimplification, but it led, I think, to a change in attitude among Americans towards extreme disrespect and skepticism about government in almost all its forms. And that just went way too far. The main cause of what's just happened to us now, and also the lost money over 40 years, has been an abdication of responsibility and authority on the part of the government. But the reason that's happened partly is Americans became very skeptical of government for wrong reasons. Not that government did not need reform, but it did not need to be enervated, demoralized, and undermined.
The other part of it that you talk about is what happened with the equity markets in the 70s, that the equity markets essentially froze, that there was no growth, and that financial institutions and banks had to look for other ways to make money within the context of these other issues.
Well, I'm glad, Jeff, you picked up so much out of the book. I really appreciate that, because that's exactly true. Not only was there a change in the attitudes of people towards government, where in the early 70s they supported taxes, and by 1978 we had a tax revolt led by Proposition 13 in California. But there was a radical change in the nature of securities markets. I got out of school in the 1970s, and everybody thought the stock market would just keep rising forever. In fact, it hit its high basically in 1969 and didn't return to that high until 1982. Stocks were no longer the place to be, but with inflation rising, with currencies loosened from the dollar by President Nixon, there were all kinds of new markets in which people could make money, essentially derivatives, options and futures contracts, on commodities from gold to pork bellies, on interest rates. You could bet on the direction of interest rates, on currencies, bet on the direction of the pound, where George Soros made so much money in the early 1990s. The nature of investing changed, but regulation never caught up to that change in investing.
Part of it, and this goes back to what you write about, particularly with Walter Wriston, who then was chairman of Citicorp, or whatever the precursor of Citicorp
right,
was.
First National City Bank.
This idea of the free flow of money, in many ways it was also the precursor of globalization in so many respects.
Oh, absolutely. Walter Wriston was a very talented and a very anti-government guy. His dad was a famous scholar during the Roosevelt New Deal, and one of the famous anti-FDR people, became president of Brown. Wriston was a talented man, joined the bank after World War II, almost against his wishes, but found he had a talent for it. And he began, even in the 1960s, learning how to subvert or circumnavigate, let's say, circumvent regulations that restricted how much money he could gather into the bank. He created the negotiable CD. I don't think we have enough time to define that in the early 60s. One of the things he did, however, was raise money in Europe. There were all these dollars sitting in banks in Europe because we had this big trade surplus in those days. And you could, if you had a branch in Europe, you could collect those dollars, pay a lot of money for them relatively, because savings rates were controlled in America by something called Regulation Q, and raise money and do deals in Europe. So he began getting around these regulations, which were in many ways sensible, maybe too restrictive as prosperity grew in the 1960s and 1970s. But Wriston learned how to circumvent them entirely, raise all kinds of money, and not be restricted by increases in interest rates. So he just kept lending and kept lending, most notoriously to South America and some African nations in the 1970s. You know, all those Arab petrodollars,
right,
when they tripled and quadrupled the price of oil, they got all those dollars. Wriston led the way in privately making lending those dollars to South America and some countries in Africa. Almost all those loans went bad by the 1980s.
The other thing that, and of course Citibank had to be bailed out then as it did more recently.
Then, more recently, very much so more recently, but also in the early 90s, you know, the irony is he hated government intervention until he needed it. He opposed bailouts of Chrysler, of another bank, Continental Illinois, but when Wriston needed it, it was okay, and he sort of called it something else. You know, some of us do that in our personal lives, you know, make exceptions for ourselves and not others.
The other thing that was going on is that in addition to all of these new products out there, all this cash that was flowing around and not finding a place in the equity markets because those weren't going anywhere and stock prices were low, we had the boom in mergers and acquisitions and takeovers taking place in the 70s.
Right. It was not only the growth of the derivatives markets, as you correctly say. People said, holy cow, stock prices are so low, let's just take over those companies. They were remarkably low. Sometimes the stock price was lower than the value of the cash and accounts receivable in a company, even when you subtracted the debt. So it looked like big bargains, but, you know, these things are slow to develop, and it took a while for companies to catch on that there were some bargains out there for them. But a Wall Street, I kind of call it an infrastructure of lawyers and investment bankers, knew they could make so much money. They were no longer making money doing what they used to do, which was issuing stock for big companies or for new companies, there was no stock market. So they started developing a very active takeover business, often hostile against the wishes of the target company's management. And that just blossomed, and it became, in my view, wild and crazy by the 1980s. And what drove it was the fact that these lawyers and investment bankers could make fortunes by encouraging companies to overpay for target companies. The other people who made fortunes were the CEOs of the takeover companies, not the targets, although sometimes even the targets. They were plied with stock options, and they were encouraged to get the, because what you had to do normally was borrow a lot of money to take over these companies. So you didn't have much room for R&D or to pay wage increases, to pay for raises. They did the contrary often. They cut labor costs. They batted down unions, and they didn't pay for R&D. There were exceptions. Some of those takeovers were good and healthy. Some companies were poorly managed and needed shaking up. But on balance, those takeovers were bad in two respects. It made no sense for companies to get together in three respects. The prices they paid, because there were bidding wars jacked up by these Wall Street people, the prices were way too high for the value received. And America consolidated. American big companies just got bigger and bigger. And I believe probably in the process, if we could measure it correctly, competition was reduced along the way in significant ways. Look at banking today. The top six banks control, I don't know what it is, 70% of finance? Or don't hold me to that. Right. The number is not fresh in my mind, but it's a crazy amount, even more than before the crisis and all the talk of financial re-regulation.
The other thing that was unique about this, and sort of an important piece in this whole story that runs from the 70s to the present, is that this was really the first period of time when great fortunes were made, not by manufacturing things, not in the industrial sector, but by moving paper around.
Right. Let's not even talk about manufacturing. Even in the service companies, even the building of television companies or, you know, the A&P, those were service companies. In the old days, that's how you made money. You built a great company. Usually they were manufacturing. Some of them were great service companies. Railroads were really a service, a transportation service. The great retailing companies, and on and on. But, you know, then there were the steel companies, the chemical companies, and so forth. For the first time since roughly about the 1970s, you could become remarkably rich. You could always become pretty rich by the standards of most of us, but remarkably rich by being a Wall Street middleman, a Wall Street broker, a Wall Street trader. Took a little piece of the action, but the action was so big you got phenomenally rich. And suddenly the Forbes 400, the biggest category in the Forbes 400 were financial people. One of the great stories is in the early 1900s, you know, the famous and legendary J.P. Morgan, by far the most powerful banker in the world then, and nobody has been comparable to him since, even Mike Milken in his heyday, the junk bond king. When J.P. Morgan died, Carnegie, I believe it was, when they saw the will, said, "My gosh, I didn't know he had so little money." Carnegie built the steel company, of course. Morgan was the middleman, the finance man, but now middlemen become billionaires, and that's new. And that incentive has made Wall Street much bigger than it was and made paper shuffling one of the main occupations in America today, the overpricing of assets, the overtrading of derivatives and other securities, in which these brokers get a little piece or often make a huge fortune, a huge killing by being on the right side of a bet. What does that contribute to American wealth? To a degree it does, but we've gone way beyond that, the benefits of Wall Street.
We've talked a little bit about the 1970s. I want to talk about the early 80s when Reagan and Volcker really came on the scene and what happened then.
Well, it was kind of interesting. President Carter, a Democrat, appointed Paul Volcker, also a Democrat, And a dedicated, I must say about Paul Volcker, he is genuinely a dedicated civil servant and not very much interested in personal wealth himself. But inflation was soaring at double-digit rates. You had to pay 18% for a mortgage. I think I bought my first car in the late 1970s, and I think I paid 18 or 19% interest. Imagine I'm paying a fifth of the value of your car every year just on interest. But the nation panicked, and Volcker was going to be the tough guy. Volcker was going to drive inflation down, even if it meant a deep, deep recession. He pushed interest rates way up to those levels I just described. And eventually, the economy slid into deep recession in 1982. Now, Reagan was elected president by then. And Reagan, of course, promised those huge tax cuts that became so popular beginning in 1978. Well, Reagan did both. He cut taxes, which theoretically should be inflationary, should add to inflation and create big deficits, while Paul Volcker was pushing up interest rates a lot. Volcker stopped inflation, not Reagan. That is totally unambiguous. Reagan had nothing to do with stopping inflation, except in one respect. He was brilliant politically. He said he supported Paul Volcker. The guys behind the scenes were upset with Volcker, but Reagan knew better than that. Let Volcker take the heat for stopping inflation. And I, Ronald Reagan, will cut taxes, and I'll be the winner on both ends. Inflation will be cut, and I'll be the great tax cutter to boot. And meanwhile, Reagan cut regulations right and left, cut the antitrust staff of Washington by half. I think the Food and Drug Administration. I'm getting my a little bit mixed up memory-wise. There are a lot of facts in this book, as I think you will attest to. But cut regulations like crazy and kept telling America that their problem was government, and let's reduce government. The irony is he never did reduce the size of government. The military budget exploded under Ronald Reagan. Even his proposed domestic cuts wouldn't have been enough to compensate for the explosion in military. Of course, the Democrats wouldn't let him cut all the way, of what he wanted to do. But
he
the consequence was budget deficits all through the Reagan administration, and very high ones.
But he certainly did cut regulation.
Cut regulation like crazy,
right.
Yeah. And you know, more than that, demoralized the regulators, made it into a crummy, low-prestige kind of profession. I think we sometimes forget that. It was not a glamorous or even considered a worthy career choice, whereas earlier in our history, being part of government, doing the government job, making an adequate living, was considered a fine life and a contribution to social justice. And indeed, the economy in America, the economy does not work without genuine regulation. The simple fact is people break the rules. And when you break the rules in the economy, and that's what these people, quote-unquote greedy people, have been doing now for 40 years, it's an unlevel playing field. And even arch-conservative economists agree that does not make for prosperity.
During this period in the 80s, the whole financial market really continued to explode. The junk bonds, Mike Milken you mentioned, Ivan Boesky, and even the complexion of American business and things that Jack Welch did at GE all changed the face of American business and economics.
I think that takeover movement, you know, Mike Milken and Ivan Boesky were Ivan Boesky profited enormously by being an arbitrageur making money on takeovers. Mike Milken's junk bonds, quite an extraordinary guy, Milken, but a guy who practiced finance in dubious ways. He was the buyer, the seller, and the middleman in the junk bond market. Financed some worthwhile companies, many not worthwhile, but financed a lot of takeovers. What happened was a takeover mentality gripped America, and Jack Welch participated in it. And the idea was get your short-term profits up for takeover targets that could keep the prey away, that could keep the attackers away, the attacking companies. You could stay independent if you could get your short-term profits up. And the stock market started rising again in the 1980s. The stock could get high enough to keep the enemy away, so to speak. But Jack Welch, who ran the huge General Electric beginning in 1980, adopted that same mentality. So the idea was get your costs down, get your profits up every quarter, look for companies that had very low labor costs, get rid of your companies that had high labor content, like basic manufacturing companies. And Jack Welch basically turned General Electric into a bank, not a manufacturing company. Half its profits came from its bank, which grew and grew, and that defined what happened. That's what this book is all about. It's the story of all these people and how we financialized America and stopped making the products and the investments we needed and enabled people to get rich through a kind of a manipulation of financial assets and securities.
Well, what's fascinating is that, and as you point out early on in the book, that this story of what happened over the 40-year period is really more than a story of economics, it's a story of individuals, and we've mentioned some of them along the way. That all seemed to change in some respects in the 90s, when it became much more faceless in many respects, but at the same time, much more corrupt.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. I didn't look at it as faceless, but I think you make an interesting point. And one of the reasons I wrote this book, and it's really a history. It's not a I got you or it's not a let's get him kind of book. It's not even a personal attacks. I think it's the true story, and you have to see the whole picture. But I think Americans don't have a real sense of their own history in this period. The 1990s were arguably the most corrupt decade in business in the 20th century, except for the 1920s. And I'm not even sure the 1920s are worse. You had to lie to keep your job on Wall Street. You had to lie about how good companies were when you know these companies couldn't make a dime. You had to lie if you were an accountant because accounting fraud was rampant in the 1990s, one company after another. You lied when you were with a major accounting firm. Many major law firms simply had to lie. They would not call it a lie. They would call it, you know, so I think in retrospect they call it a lie. Certainly the Wall Street analysts who lied now admit what happened. There are all kinds of documentation and admissions about that. It became very corrupt, and among the consequences, of course, was that high technology fantasy boom of the late 1990s, which helped the economy temporarily and then led to that enormous crash, stock market crash in 2000 and 2001. Wall Street and accountants and lawyers were in effect promoting these fantasies in order to get themselves rich, especially the Wall Street people. And, you know, people keep asking me, who are the heroes of your books? There are and we're in a high-technology part of the world here. There are lots of heroic high-technology people. But also, a lot of these high-technology startups participated in some of these corrupt practices, underpricing their initial public offerings so they could make a killing on their own stock when they went up afterwards, backdating stock options. So this was, and this is why I call it an age of greed, this age of greed was a cultural phenomenon. And worse than that, it really reversed history because we learned that we needed regulations in the 1930s and some continuing regulations. We learned that lesson of history as capitalism developed and became enormous. And we reversed, we unlearned that lesson, beginning with people like Walter Wriston, unlearned it aggressively. And we've got to learn it again, and I'm not very optimistic we will.
And it's interesting to look at the 90s because leading up to it, and some of the people we've talked about, certainly made a profound difference. Some of them may have gone too far, whether it was people like Milken and Boesky or Joe Flaum or Walter Wriston, who we talked about, or Charlie Bluthorn during the takeover period. All of those people, there was good and bad. Once you get to the 90s, once you get to Enron and long-term capital management and some of what was going on there, there's very little good or very little creativity that you find other than the corruption that existed.
Well, by the late 1990s, we were getting really fantasy deals. Of course, the Internet revolution occurred in that period, so there was some, you know, substantial good that came out of it, but those companies had been underway and reach a sort of critical mass at that time. And also, I think the technology and costs of semiconductors came down so far that suddenly PCs were widely affordable and so forth, and we made great innovative strides. But you're right. For the most part, Wall Street was abusing America. Enron, WorldCom, supported by banks like J.P. Morgan and Citigroup at the time, supported by Wall Street analysts who said they were great companies. And yet these people were thieves. They were putting money into partnerships, hiding liabilities, inflating profits quite consciously. And a couple of them went to jail, not too many. A couple of them went to jail. But by the early 2000s, the same people who were promoting these guys were now promoting the securitization of mortgages. Citigroup led the way. Citigroup was the most fined company, and I think the subject of the most civil litigation after Enron and WorldCom and some of those other horrible, huge bankruptcy deceptive companies. And yet it became a leader in the mortgage market. Almost all the companies did. A leader in the securitization of mortgages, and once again in the hiding of their liabilities off their balance sheet, for which there is at least civil action occurring, and maybe we'll even see some Justice Department action. Certainly the Attorney General in New York and I think the Manhattan prosecutors are talking about it, and there's some action from the Department of Justice. I'm not sure where all of it's going. Quite an extraordinary ride we've been on, but it began in the 70s, and I think the story is people. It's not a thesis. It's not like Toynbee, what caused history to change climate. I don't think the world is that simple. I wanted to tell the story in terms of the people who made it, and in fact, I think it becomes a more interesting read that way.
And in terms of the broader issues, one of the things that you start and end with is this notion that there are two spheres that are operating. One is what's happening within the business cycle, within the business sphere, the competition, capitalism, and the other, the sort of cooperative general good, and the way these two things need to interact and overlap each other has gotten out of balance.
I think so. I often, when I give talks, I draw two circles in the air. One I call the competition sphere, the business sphere, and the other the cooperation general good sphere, usually government. And we began to believe, and I talk a lot about Milton Friedman, we began to believe in America, and he believed this, that the competition business sphere is all you needed for social justice. And in fact, it's, I see on the talk shows, it's kind of making a comeback from the right wing. They allude to Hayek in these terms. Milton Friedman's sort of out of style now. Hayek sounds more lofty, I think, to people. And they say, oh, social justice will come from economic competition and pricing and stuff. It's just not true. In America, and what happened was we began to believe in that, this change of attitudes, this laissez-faire at all costs, and it pushed aside the cooperations general good circle, as I describe it. And we need to get the balance back, because America only worked well when there was balance and those two overlapped. Think of water systems. The Hoover Dam was built in the Depression when we had no darn money, the biggest dam in the world, not by private industry, but by government. Not for one state's use, but for the use of providing water in many states, including, most important to the national economy, Southern California. Cooperation, not competition. We need a balance between both. I'm the last person to say capitalism doesn't work. I'm the first person to say it doesn't work when it's the only thing around and not subject to oversight. Self-interest is good. It turns into damaging greed when government abdicates its responsibilities.
And finally, the other question is whether or not it's too late, whether all the things that we've neglected in this are salvageable given where we are today.
I worry about that a lot, Jeff. And I hate to end this on a down note. I think what's most important for America to realize, as I look at history, and I keep saying that I wrote a history, not a book just about this moment, but a book about how we got to this moment. As I look at history, it is not inevitable. America will not inevitably muddle through We solved problems in the past. Sometimes we waited too long. Sometimes we didn't solve them well enough. But we did it because people took action. And I think the most important thing we have to realize in America is these problems don't solve themselves. We don't just muddle through. We have to take responsibility. And that means serious re-regulation of finance and cutting down of power of the financial community. And we're not nearly there as yet.
Jeff Madrick, his book is Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, just out from Knopf. Jeff, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, Jeff, thank you for the excellent interview. I really appreciate your putting that effort into it.
Thank you.